Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the Obama administration goes to Capitol Hill with the Iran nuclear deal. Concern in Gulf states about the Iran impact.
The principal worry about Iran isn't really nuclear. It's about Iran being a major conventional threat with stature that has the capacity to meddle in Arab affairs.
Possible action by the U.S. Congress to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations. And the throwback musical sound of a former punker. It's all ahead on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry today begins the task of briefing members of Congress on the international nuclear agreement with Iran, with closed-door sessions followed by public testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee scheduled Thursday. It's part of the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, overwhelmingly approved by lawmakers and signed into law by President Obama in May. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. Since that nuclear deal was not agreed to in Vienna until last week, Congress has, beginning last Monday, 60 days to review the accord and accept or reject it. President Obama has threatened to veto any rejection, but the veto could be overwritten by a two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress. On Monday, the agreement was unanimously endorsed by the UN Security Council, aiming at restricting Iran's nuclear program while lifting sanctions. Mr. Obama, in remarks Tuesday to a veterans group, called the Iran nuclear deal an example of the strength of American diplomacy.
We're now engaged in an important debate, which is a good thing. We are a democracy. Unfortunately, you may have noticed there's already a lot of shaky information out there. So even as I make the case of why this is a critical deal to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, we're going to make sure the people know the facts. And here are some basic facts. With this deal, we cut off every single one of Iran's pathways to a nuclear program. Iran is prohibited from pursuing a nuclear weapon permanently. Without a deal, those paths remain open and Iran could move closer to a nuclear bomb. With this deal, we gain unprecedented access to Iran's nuclear facilities and monitor them 24/7. Without a deal, we don't get that. With this deal, if Iran cheats, sanctions snap back on. Without a deal, the sanctions unravel. With this deal, we have a chance to resolve the challenge of Iran trying to get a nuclear weapon peacefully. Without it, we risk yet another conflict in the Middle East. Now, if Iran tries to get a bomb despite this agreement, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, the American president will be in a stronger position to take whatever additional steps are necessary, including any option of military action, to prevent that from happening. And those are the facts. That's the choice. And for the sake of our national security and the sake of future generations, we need to make the right choice on this critical issue.
Mr. Obama called the agreement a smarter, more responsible way to protect the U.S. national interest, and he challenged critics of the deal who, in his words, were so quick to go to war in Iraq a decade ago. On the eve of Mr. Kerry's appearance on Capitol Hill, a key Democrat came out in support of the deal. Assistant Democratic Senate Leader Dick Durbin said on Tuesday that given a choice of invading Iran, he prefers negotiation to lessen this threat to the world. However, Wyoming Republican Senator John Barroso said there is bipartisan skepticism of the agreement, which he calls complex and riddled with concessions to Iran. A congressional vote is unlikely until sometime in September. Regional analyst Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver told me in the end he believes Congress will support the Iran deal, with at least 34 votes needed in the Senate, 146 in the House of Representatives.
A number of leading Democrats, like Chuck Schumer, for example, have been very critical about this, and he is touted to be the next majority leader when the Democrats regain control of the Senate. And they're particularly angry, not only about what went on and how it was negotiated, but especially because the United States Congress wasn't really involved. The president bypassed the Congress at the beginning, and he bypassed them at the end, when instead of waiting the 60 days, which he himself had agreed to, he went to the United Nations Security Council, leaving the Congress to do what? Very little. But he did anger people not only in the Republican Party, which is to be expected, but in the Democratic Party, who said, we want to participate in what is probably the most important agreement that has been reached in at least 20 years with another power.
The supreme leader of Iran indicated that Iranian policy will not be impacted by the nuclear agreement, that Iran will continue to pursue its policies. Secretary Kerry, in an interview with the Saudi network Al Arabiya, called that very disturbing.
It is very disturbing, and this is all predicated that we are seeing change in the other side. We don't see any example of this in Iran. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. We look at what the rest of the speech was from the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, and when we look at it, it ended with death to the United States, death to Israel, and our military institutions will not be inspected. We are hoping it's propaganda. But this is something very worrisome. I just wrote an op-ed about this, saying that if we go back in history, like World War II, we see leaders who actually told us before the war started, like Adolf Hitler, the kind of war they're going to wage. Nobody believed him. Nobody believed Mussolini, and they didn't believe Imperial Japan. So I just hope, for the sake of our country, that the president is right, and his critics, of whom I'm one of them, obviously, am wrong. But I deeply believe that this will tend to greatly reinforce the power of the Grand Ayatollah and the hardliners, and the $100 to $150 billion they're going to make will be something that will be spent not on making the lives of their people better, but on military hardware, on missile and rocket production, and all those things that make the Middle East such a dangerous place today.
Edelman also says he is surprised the fate of four Americans, either in detention or unaccounted for in Iran, should have been on the negotiating table in Vienna, and the resolution of the issue could have been a sign of goodwill on the part of Tehran. He says it's a sign, rather to him, of insufficient diplomatic pressure put on Iran in those negotiations.
Well, thank you, Victor, for that report.
Thank you, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what do you have to share?
Well, the top trending hashtag on Twitter this morning is hashtag Twitterblock in Turkey. Now, we talked about a couple days ago the bombing in Suruç, Turkey, on the Syrian border that left 32 people dead.
Yes.
After that bombing, people in Turkey posting images of the bombing. Turkey's government then banned Twitter, saying that it didn't want people to share the images. Mm-hmm. People are also accusing the Turkish government, however, of blocking Twitter to block protests against the government and calls for the government to do more to stop these kind of attacks. Now, it's interesting that this hashtag is trending because more people in Turkey, it seems, are going on Twitter now than before this ban. They're using VPNs, which are ways to get around the different blocks that they do by country.
It's the old story, if you tell them not to do it, they're going to want to do it even more.
Exactly. So people are commenting exactly on that, saying it's only going to make us, you know, the Turkish people want to go on more to social media. So that story is trending this morning, and we're going to see more on that and see if Turkey lifts the ban or if it remains in place. Another story that's been trending is out of the entertainment world. Taylor Swift and Nicki Minaj, two of the biggest artists in the world. Yes.
Talk about a cat fight.
A little bit. Nicki Minaj live tweeting as the Video Music Awards, MTV Video Music Awards nominations were announced, said, "If your video celebrates women with very slim bodies, you'll be nominated for Video of the Year," seemingly a dig at Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift responding said, "I have nothing but love and support for you. I don't know why you'd call me out on this." So they're going back and forth on that. The interesting thing is it's inspired a debate on feminism and feminism among women of color, which has been an interesting debate. A lot of people piling onto this saying, well, Taylor Swift says she's a feminist, but is she standing up for women who look like Nicki Minaj? So it's interesting that this kind of fight back and forth between these two celebrities have actually inspired quite a debate on a very pertinent issue.
But I also heard that in the end, they got back together again, and they're all friends again.
Yes, Taylor said, "If I win, I want you to come up on stage with me, Nicki." So hopefully they've patched things up, but still, like I said, inspiring some interesting conversation.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Russian billionaire Yuri Milner and renowned theoretical physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking gave the search for extraterrestrial intelligence a significant boost when they recently announced the formation of the $100 million Breakthrough Initiatives. The multidisciplinary project will span 10 years and use the world's largest telescopes to mine data from the nearest 1 million stars in the Milky Way and some 100 other galaxies. The first two of these initiatives include Breakthrough Listen, which organizers say will be the most powerful, wide-ranging, and intensive scientific search for signs of intelligent life in the cosmos. The second initiative, called Breakthrough Message, will be a $1 million international competition to compose digital messages that represent humanity and our planet, which one day could be sent to other civilizations beyond Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
President Obama has affirmed to the Arab Gulf leaders that the nuclear agreement with Iran will prevent Tehran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and that the U.S. is as committed to working with them to counter Iran's destabilizing activities in the region. The U.S. Secretary of Defense will reiterate such resolve when he meets with Saudi officials during his current trip to the Middle East. International Edition's senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed the impact of the deal with Iran on the region. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Mohammed, some experts were alarmed that the Iranian nuclear ambition could have started a nuclear race in the Middle East, especially with the ample resources of the oil-rich Gulf states. But now, with the Iranian nuclear threat possibly contained, why are Arab Gulf states worried?
Actually, Sue, while the Gulf states do not want to see a nuclear Iran, that was not their major concern, according to Professor Shibli Talhami of the University of Maryland.
The principal worry about Iran isn't really nuclear. It's about Iran being a major conventional threat with stature that has a capacity to meddle in Arab affairs and to influence politics in the region and to have conventional capabilities that would enable it to support militias in the region that are at odds with some of the Arab states' interests.
What worry Arab countries in that respect is that with over $100 billion of sanctions relief, Iran might be tempted to use additional funds to finance militant groups in Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen. That's why Secretary of State John Kerry said that the United States is committed to work with the Gulf partners to push back against any extremist enterprises, including the Iranian activities in the region.
Mohammed, if we look at the full half of the cup, is there any potential constructive role in the region to be expected from Iran after the nuclear deal?
Well, some analysts assume that the United States can persuade Iran to help countering the so-called Islamic State in Iraq using its influence among Iraqi Shiites. But Professor Talhami warns that playing the sectarian card is counterproductive.
Iran has been supporting Shia militias that the United States sees as a big threat to the stability of Iraq itself. And let's not forget that part of the rise of ISIS filling that vacuum of disenfranchisement by the Sunni population that has been frustrated by what they see as sectarian government. And I don't think you can produce an outcome in Iraq that is going to be stable among the particularly Sunni population that is not cooperating with ISIS if you then rely on sectarianism as a solution. Sectarianism is a problem.
However, Professor Talhami argues that the Iranians could be very helpful in Syria, applying some needed pressure on the Assad regime to reach a political solution in Syria. He said that if Iran played such a role, that would be the first step to isolate ISIS fighters in Syria, where they have a stronghold.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for stopping by with that report.
Thank you.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
On International Edition, the historic changing of U.S.-Cuban relations, and musician Elle King making her way up the charts. The United States and Cuba are reopening their embassies after 54 years, but there are many layers of U.S. legislation passed over the years that have to be resolved before there are full relations between the two nations. Joining me is Jeffrey Young, who spoke to an analyst about this. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. I had a conversation with senior political scientist Angel Rabassa at the RAND Corporation in Washington about this legislative thicket and what it will take to clear things.
The first point is that the Obama administration and the Cuban government have probably reached at this point the limits of what can be done with executive authority, without congressional involvement. The Treasury and Commerce Department have eased restrictions on travel, remittances, trade, including communication services and financial services. However, for any further sanctions to be lifted, that would require the congressional action, because these sanctions are codified in U.S. legislation going back to the 1960s, and also the Cuban Liberty Act of 1992, Cuban Democracy Act of 1992, and the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act of 1996.
Aren't there steps that the Cuban government has to take in order to satisfy that legislation? Can you explain that?
One of the reasons for significant opposition in the Congress and to the deal that has been cut to seek to normalize relations with Cuba is that there are a number of issues of concern to the United States that the Cuban government has not taken steps to resolve. For instance, there is the case of political repression that has significantly increased since the announcement of normalization of relations. The Cubans are giving a sanctuary to a number of fugitives from U.S. justice, including a woman who was involved in the execution style of a New Jersey state trooper in the 1980s and who's free in Cuba. And there are a number of other issues. But the problem here, again, is that there hasn't been any movement, really, on the part of the Cuban government toward the goals that are anticipated in U.S. sanctions legislation.
That was RAND Corporation senior political scientist Angel Rabassa discussing the legislative task Congress needs to take in order to fully normalize relations between the United States and Cuba.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
You're tuned to VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Feeling better might be as simple as taking a walk in the woods. Researchers from Stanford University followed about 40 mentally healthy individuals, half of whom were told to take a 90-minute walk through the city. The others were told to take that walk through nature. Upon return, the subjects who walked through nature exhibited less of what brain scientists call rumination or brooding.
This type of thinking is highly associated with onset of depression. If we looked at the parts of the brains that are active during rumination, and we noticed a decrease in the nature participants, but no change in the urban.
Stanford PhD student Gregory Bratman says he doesn't know how much time in natural environments is needed to reap mood-enhancing benefits, but a suggestion.
We need to start thinking about how we can integrate nature back into cities.
Half the world's population now lives in cities. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
She started in a punk band at age 9 and comes from a famous family. Now musician Elle King has a new song making its way up the charts. VOA's Larry London spoke with International Edition's David Byrd about King, her famous roots, and her throwback sound.
She has roots in show business, and her music career is just taking off. We're talking about Elle King. Larry, what do we know about her?
Well, here's what we know. Elle King is the daughter of Saturday Night Live alum Rob Schneider, who's appeared in many Adam Sandler films over the years. Although he's a comedic actor, he's not known for music. But she grew up in showbiz in Los Angeles. She's always loved music. She was in a punk band at the age of 9, and these days she's kind of more associated with rock and blues. In fact, the song we're going to play, which is her latest release from her debut studio album, Love Stuff, is at number 2 on the alternative charts already. She's doing very, very well, and she's been on tour with the band Train.
And her song is charting, so what's the name of the tune?
The name of the song, X's and O's.
I had me a boy, turned him into a man. I showed him all the things that he didn't understand. Whoa. Then I let him go. Now there's one in California who can curse my name. Cause I found me a better lover in the UK. Hey. Until I made my getaway. 1, 2, 3, they're gonna run back to me. Cause I'm the best.
Very, very talented young girl who's great at songwriting and very talented singer. If you think Bonnie Raitt, if you remember the Bonnie Raitt blues,
oh, yeah,
rock, sound.
I Can't Make You Love Me.
There you go.
Those
well,
kind of things.
Even If I Buy You Flowers?
No.
And then there's
that's
Melissa,
another song.
Melissa Etheridge and people like that, the blues rock sound, much in that vein. And, you know, she plays banjo as well as a rock guitar, loves to write music. She studied painting and arts at Philadelphia's University of the Arts, and a very artistic, creative girl.
So she's got creds, regardless of whether this music thing works out or not.
And she also says that her influence in music, among many, is Blondie.
Okay. All right. So that kind of what we used to call the scotch and cigarettes voice. That
there
kind
you go.
Of scratchy,
exactly.
Smoky. Bonnie Tyler.
Bonnie Tyler. Alana Miles.
All right. Well, we'll look for her. If you are a fan of Elle King, you can let us know by hitting Larry up at VOA_music. You can also send me a tweet. I'm at David_DBird. That's D as in David, D Bird. And you can also send a tweet to @VOA_IE if you want to hear Larry's program, Border Crossings. That's on our website at www.voanews.com.
Would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An African Union-backed court in Senegal has begun proceedings in the trial of former Chadian leader Hissène Habré, accused of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and torture committed during his 8-year rule from 1982 to 1990. The opening of the case in Dakar is an historic step for African justice, marking the first time that the courts of one country on the continent have prosecuted the former ruler of another for alleged human rights crimes. The trial concludes a 15-year battle by victims and rights campaigners to bring the former strongman to justice in Senegal, where he fled after being toppled in a 1990 coup. Habré is blamed for widespread torture and the killing of up to 40,000 people while leading the Central African nation. The United States commends the government of Senegal and the African Union for bringing the former Chadian president before the Extraordinary African Chambers of Senegal. As a signal of our support for these proceedings, U.S. Ambassador to Senegal James Zumwalt and Ambassador-at-Large for War Crimes Issues Stephen Rapp attended the opening of the trial on July 20th. This trial is an important step toward justice for the victims of atrocities committed under Habré's rule and should serve as yet another warning that, no matter their position, perpetrators of atrocities will be held accountable. The United States supports a fair and impartial trial and is committed to helping end impunity for the worst crimes known to humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA.